Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you for our Tuesday podcast. On my mind, the U.S. prides itself on being a country of innovation. But even in the land that built the Internet, our ability to get access to high-speed, quality service is not on par with other countries in Europe and Asia. My guest today, Harvard Law Professor Susan Crawford, says as the country slips further behind, we jeopardize our place as a leader in the tech revolution. Susan Crawford's new book is titled Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution, and Why America Might Miss It. Susan, let's begin with the direct question of what fiber is and why it's so important.
Well, I talked to my dry cleaner in New York City yesterday about fiber because he's reading this book and he's so excited about the description of what it does. It's just a hair-thin strand of glass that's been so perfectly manufactured that it's so pure that a signal can go through fiber. It's basically light is going through this fiber for dozens of miles without being amplified or boosted or encouraged.
So it's glass.
It's glass in a sense, but it's been so carefully prepared. Every micro-thin layer has a different recipe, in essence, so that they can make sure that there's absolutely no impurity in it. So it has to be manufactured very carefully. But once it's in the ground, as far as we can tell, it has an unlimited capacity to carry information.
So here in the U.S., how widespread is fiber?
There's actually a lot of fiber in the U.S. and between the U.S. and other countries running under the sea and submarine channels. And between every city in the United States, there's definitely fiber optic cable. The problem is between individual houses and businesses and the next node up in the internet, the next connection up the stream, there usually isn't fiber. There's very little fiber, actually, in the United States. Where, by contrast, in countries like South Korea and Japan, even that last little bit of the network is made up of fiber. And it's that choke point, that bottleneck, that's of great concern to this country.
I gather you were recently in South Korea.
I've been fortunate enough to go to South Korea several times and to Japan and to Sweden and to China and to Hong Kong and Singapore, places that have fiber optic connections running into homes and businesses.
So what's the difference?
The difference, and this is actually almost funny, South Koreans feel that coming to the United States is like taking a peaceful rural vacation because life is so unconnected here. And in Japan, the same thing. Everything just works. Communications work there, and they never have to think or worry about the expense or the availability of a communications channel for whatever they want to do.
So they have laid a lot more fiber than we here in the U.S. have.
In particular, they've made sure that that very last connection between a home and business and the next up node is made of fiber. And then across that, they've made sure that there are lots of competitors providing retail service. So the result is you can get basically unlimited capacity at about $35 or $40 a month, which is what it should cost. It's just a utility. And that's how it's seen in South Korea and Japan and these other places, but not in the United States.
How come?
This happened not by accident, but because of policy failures over the last 20 years. Basically, we've been treating internet access like a commodity, like a tuna fish sandwich or a new dress, and assuming that the free market left to its own devices will upgrade and compete and protect consumers, make sure that we have cheap prices and world-class connectivity. It turns out that that's not the case when it comes to basic infrastructure. The private marketplace, left to its own devices, not malign or anything, will systematically pick the richest areas to serve and divide up markets so that they don't have to compete with each other and then not upgrade ever. So that's what we've got in America. We've got a large section of the country left behind because it's viewed as not profitable enough for our private internet access companies. And then very little competition in urban areas when it comes to high capacity internet access, and no plan to upgrade to these very last bit fiber connections. By contrast, China plans to have 80% of its homes connected to fiber optic in the next few years.
Now, tell me what the connection is between fiber optics and 5G, because there's been lots of talk about 5G, the next coming revolution, and how we must have fiber optics to ensure that we are at that point.
5G is really reaching a height of the hype cycle at this point. It's true that you can't have these advanced wireless services without having fiber optic cables very deep into neighborhoods and close to homes and businesses. Wireless requires a wire. Saying we could just have advanced wireless, who needs these wires, is like saying, who needs airports? I've got an airplane. You need to be able to take that data and put it on a wire somewhere very close by so that it can reach the rest of the internet. What we know about 5G, which has not yet been standardized yet as an international protocol, is that it will be very high capacity, but only over very short distances, and won't be able to penetrate walls and buildings. So far, what Verizon's doing when it's installing what is labeling 5G in about four cities in the United States and in very small pockets in those cities right now, is picking up this very high capacity wireless signal from the outside of a home and then drilling a hole through the wall of the house, putting a wire through that wall, and then having a little, hotspot inside the home. So 5G is terrific. Or will be, we hope, but has its limitations. And one of those is that wireless is very easily interfered with, particularly when it's so high frequency. These very quickly wobbling waves get sort of nervous when they approach a wall or a big bag of water known as a human being. They don't penetrate those things. And so it's great if you can be, it's called line of sight, if you can have your wireless hotspot able to look at a source of data, but it won't actually be a substitute for wires entering homes and businesses. Long story short, 5G, terrific, requires fiber to be effective, and will not solve our grotesque digital divides in this country inwardly, or our divide as a country with the rest of the world that is moving swiftly towards fiber optic deep penetration.
So what's it going to mean for the U.S. not to be keeping up with these other countries?
Well, we're essentially going to be living in the past where other countries are living in the future. And what that means is that the new ways of making a living, the new forms of jobs and sort of human endeavors that are going to be created to take advantage of these very high capacity networks won't come from the U.S. We have been in the lead so far with the birth of the internet. After all, it started off here, and we should be looking the rest of the world in the rearview mirror, but we will not be. We will be trailing behind almost like a sort of Rome, a beautiful place with terrible infrastructure that might be good for tourism, but not for globally significant developments in particularly information. And this is, of course, of a piece with a lot of other deficits the United States is experiencing when it comes to infrastructure.
But you know, Susan, this does not sound like us. This country has always been so competitive, so racing to be out front. What is holding us back here?
You're absolutely right. We have been historically impatient, and we think of ourselves as leading the globe. And that's why this story that I'm telling causes such cognitive dissonance for Americans who don't travel. If you haven't experienced what it's like to be in an Asian country where things, especially communications, just work well, and you never have to wait, and you never have to think about how your business is going to reach its customers, you don't realize the darkness into which we're sinking. And the worry is that Americans will continue to sort of believe we're exceptional without recognizing that we need profound structural rework of sectors like telecom in order to keep up with the rest of the world.
And what is the reluctance on the part of the companies who could do this?
Well, they are rational. We've got about five companies in the United States controlling internet access in America, AT&T and Verizon, mostly wireless. They've retreated from this wired side of the story I've been talking about. On the wired side, the cable companies, largely Comcast and Charter, now Spectrum, are controlling many metro areas in the United States when it comes to wired connections into homes and businesses. They are completely rational in wanting to keep the status quo in place. It is serving their interests very well. And their shareholders are no doubt extremely happy. The problem is, in order to serve the interests of these five companies, everybody else in America is suffering, including the thousands of businesses that are not able to experiment with what might otherwise be a giant market for new kinds of goods and services that would take advantage of having high-capacity networking everywhere.
Then why haven't those businesses been pushing those companies for more and more fiber?
Well, this is, again, like so many stories in America right now, that a very small group of companies with enough heft and cash can keep the political process pretty much under control. We only get a healthy environment for telecommunications where we take the regulatory ideal seriously. The regulatory ideal is that you give a basic, decent network, make that available to all Americans and all American businesses, which allows the free market to thrive on top of it. But only with a pretty strong hand on the regulatory tiller does this happen. And we've taken that hand off. This entire industry has been completely deregulated. So the companies that I've listed are under no obligation from the regulator and no pressure from competition to change their ways.
Some people have compared their reluctance to what happened with the Tennessee Valley Authority, that there was this reluctance to electrify that part of the country because it served the interests of those who had the power not to move forward. It finally took an act of Congress. So does Congress get into this?
Actually, because of that era, right after the Depression, we passed a statute for communications that contains all of these public values, that has the idea embedded in it that every American deserves a world-class communication service. The problem is that the FCC has found ways to avoid that statute through its labeling, let's call it, of high-speed internet access as a non-utility, as not being covered by that statute. So we have a perfectly good statutory structure. It's just that it's not being used by the current FCC to support the interests of all Americans.
And why is that the case?
A lot of bamboozlement and blandishment and confusion and bad data. The regulator has just been convinced that if you draw the circle very widely around what constitutes internet access, so you include a crappy wireless signal with a high-capacity fiber optic signal, within that market so broadly defined, they believe there is competition. But that's like saying the Gonzaga football team is just like the Rams. You know, yes, they're both football teams, but you don't put them on the same playing field. And they're not, these communications companies are under no obligation to provide rural customers with the same level of service they get in urban areas, or to ensure that poor Americans have access to a reasonably priced world-class communication service. We've just given up on that entire story.
It's so interesting because you'd think that stockholders themselves would see that expanding this would actually bring more profit to them as stockholders.
Well, actually, they see that making more money from existing infrastructure is the most profitable way to go. So none of these companies has a plan of expanding the number of people who take their services. They want to avoid ruinous competition. This is always true of basic infrastructure. It's so expensive to build as an initial matter that left to their own devices, companies will routinely divide markets and avoid competition and make sure that their existing subscribers are paying ever more for premium services. So that's the story.
Susan, you have always been a something of a provocateur.
Yes.
So now that your new book is out, what have you heard from those companies whom you say are just not paying attention?
Well, I've been listening to their recent earnings calls about the fourth quarter of 2018. They're doing extremely well, and they're not reacting to this story that I tell in Fiber about 800 localities in America taking matters into their own hands and building what amounts to a public option, a fiber optic network for their citizens so that they can get cheap and great communications access. By not putting this on the radar screen of politicians, the current companies hope to just continue the status quo. It's all fine from their perspective.
And members of Congress in whose districts those wastelands are not pushing for something new to be done.
Unfortunately, there is a problem of tremendous short-termism, even in members of Congress. You know, they have to get reelected constantly. And so they have to worry about political pushback coming from these extraordinarily well-connected companies in the form of money, obviously, to their opposing numbers, anybody running against them, but also being labeled as somehow anti-American for not supporting this handful of companies. What's happened in America is that we've fallen in love with the idea that profit-making is the only thing of value. And we've lost the notion that there really is a line between public and private, and that it is only in the public sector's interest to ensure that everybody in the country has the respect inherent in an adequate and cheap communication service reaching them. Because we believe in the magic of the market, and because the political power of these incumbents is so enormous, there's almost no political upside for a current-day politician to take on this enormous issue. My hope is that these local leaders who are building these public options will eventually embarrass the federal government into taking action. That's what happens with electricity. Had FDR not noticed that there were all these agricultural cooperatives in small towns taking matters into their own hands and ensuring an electrification service that was cheap, he likely would not have gone up against the then wholly private power industry that was running electricity in America. That private power industry tried to destroy FDR as he ran for president in 1932. They tried to keep him from being the candidate, and then they tried to bring him down when he was running for office. And it took his enormous personal resilience and grit to stand up against that opposition. I'm hopeful that leaders like that will emerge who deeply understand this issue and understand that Americans at their best are never cynical, and Americans at their best respect everybody around them and believe that the decency of communication should be accorded everyone.
And now a quick break. More when we come back from Susan Crawford.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture,
and
curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here is the rest of my conversation with Susan Crawford. Her new book is titled Fiber, The Coming Tech Revolution and Why America Might Miss It. So you're out there talking about this. You're speaking very forcefully about the need for this. When did you first begin realizing there was a huge gap here between what was happening in this country and elsewhere?
I made a trip to South Korea. I made a trip there because somebody asked me to make a speech in New York City, and I needed something to talk about. And I'd always been interested in South Korea. And so I decided to just fling myself there and start talking to people in their 20s about what life was like. So this happened in the early 2010s. And I gradually began to understand that the young people I was meeting in South Korea were living effectively a different life from the students I knew in America. And I was a curious person, and I began to investigate, and the story unfolded itself in front of me. Had I not made those journeys, I would have remained behind the veil of ignorance that most Americans are under. I just happen to be lucky.
Give me an example of how those students in South Korea are living different lives from those here in this country.
It's a two-sided story. From a communications perspective, South Koreans are extremely impatient. They won't wait for anything, a train, a signal, a conversation, anything to happen online. They're ready to move. And they assume that communications capacity is always there. And those kids I met felt as if they were living simultaneously online and offline. There's no distinction for them. It's one seamless environment for their lives. And there's no sense of checking out and becoming separate from friends or family who are distant. They felt an ambient sense of awareness of their friends and family. On the other hand, because of the crushing hierarchy in South Korea and the rote-like way they're educated and the enormous power of Samsung, the conglomerate there, I also felt that those kids did not have the sparkiness and the spunkiness and the grit of my friends and students in their 20s in America. So actually, I gain hope from this story. South Korea may have tremendous connectivity, but they're not us. We, as Americans, are willing to try new things and fail, willing to take risks, find new ways of learning, connect with people easily. We're sort of chatty. And that kind of resilience and cheerfulness, frankly, I didn't find in my South Korean kids who I talked to.
There are tons of people, Susan, who would say, why do we need to go any faster? Why do we need to communicate more quickly?
Well, you know, it's very similar to the people who said, I've got one light bulb in my house. Why do I need any more electricity? We're limited as human beings. We can't imagine what could be possible using higher capacity networks, just as we couldn't imagine domestic uses of electricity in the early part of the last century. Look, they were rolling an electric kitchen across the countryside of Ireland deep into the 60s because people didn't believe that electricity was good for anything inside houses. Today, we take persistent and terrific electricity, affordance as part of our lives. What's possible using these high capacity networks is eye contact, which we've never had using traditional internet access. That carries with it all kinds of developments that you could be present in a doctor's office through a pane of glass, effectively. That's what this connection feels like. So you feel the empathy and compassion of the doctor. You feel the learning experience in a classroom. People can care for each other at a distance. As someone with an elderly mother, I'm really interested in this as a future of keeping people accompanied in an ambient and friendly way. For musicians, imagine having just a pane of glass between you and someone remote that you're collaborating with. You can have eye contact. There's no delay. You actually are playing together. So just amplify that. I know we haven't even touched on what's possible using these higher capacity networks, but it all starts with human presence. We can stop getting on planes to go to business meetings. You really can be there and not be a second-class citizen because you're calling in and everybody's saying, what? What did you say?
We can
stop doing that. And especially in an era of such great concern about sea level rise and climate change, that seems an important thing for us to be looking at as a nation.
Tell me about climate change.
Yes.
And what you think fiber, the introduction of fiber on a more widespread basis in this country, how would that help?
We're going to have an awful lot of climate refugees who have to move away from the coasts and move away more quickly than we might have imagined. The drumbeat of bad news about sea level rise with Greenland and the Arctic melting faster than we ever thought means that we're going to have to resettle people. And those people, in order to have thriving human lives and to stay connected with family members across the continent, are going to require terrific communications capacity that allows for this kind of human presence. We'll have to plan ahead for transit, for communications, for all of these basic things. Fiber underlies every policy we care about as a country. If we want people to get terrific health care without the costs of hospitalization on a coast, by the way, we're going to need to have fiber everywhere. If we want people to have a world-class education, no matter where they are, we'll need fiber. So climate change is deeply connected to the need for better communications capacity inland in the United States.
What about protection from the threat of terrorism? How does fiber play a role there?
Well, resilient communications networks that don't keel over because they're controlled by a single actor when attacked are extremely important. This not paying attention to this entire area is posing a dramatic national security risk to the United States. We need redundant, terrific, very high caliber communications in order to keep all of our systems rolling in the event of a terrorist attack. Now, people will say terrorists will use internet connections. And of course, that's right. And terrorists use telephones too. But the burdens of that risk are far outweighed by the benefits to all parts of a functioning democratic society of courting people the respect of a basic world-class communications connection that's cheap.
Finally, the question becomes how long the U.S. has before it's really left behind.
The grave risk here is China. So China has announced that it's going to connect 80% of its households to fiber optic at a time when, as far as we can tell, maybe 10% of U.S. households will be part of this next century with fiber optic connections. And China also plans to extend its internet, in essence, through its Silk Belt Road plan, covering about 70 other countries and their ports in the world. So what this will provide China is a giant marketplace that becomes the sandbox for new developments, for the new things, the new industries, the new applications of this network. By contrast, the U.S. has no plan. So I don't know how much time we have, but I can see that the action is not in the United States when by rights it really should be.
Susan, is there a political upside or downside to either party?
What's lovely about this issue, Diane, is that it's thoroughly bipartisan. Most of the 800 municipalities or cooperatives working on public option fiber networks across the country are Republican. For a Republican mayor, this makes total sense. You know, why not have your citizens get the decency of a high capacity connection? It means businesses will move to town. It means kids will stay in that town and not move away. It means a thriving place. So the upside here, the really bright spot of light, is that in all my journeys across the United States, talking to leaders who were working on these fiber networks, no one mentioned politics in terms of party. No one mentioned Mr. Trump, actually. This was all about local initiatives to do the best they could by their citizens.
That's good to hear.
It's a very bright spot.
Susan Crawford, as always, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And that's all for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. You can find all our podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianerehm.org. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineer this week is Natalie Yurev-Livker. Thanks for listening. I'll be back with you on Friday. I'm Diane Rehm.